I will call this hearing of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. Today is January 26, 2023. We do have a quorum present. Members, before we get into the business on the agenda today, I do want to remind everyone that there are rules in this committee and that we are going to follow them. So you should have in your folders the rules and procedures for this committee. Rule 4 is that appropriate and respectful decorum is required. During the hearing, all presentations, discussions, and questions must go through and be recognized by the chair. Things got a little bit out of hand on Tuesday, and that is not going to be tolerated in this committee. You know, the same rules and Masons that give the minority and everybody in this body the same equality to speak are the same rules that require you to do that respectfully. Folks may know that I'm a Masons person. I like the rules. Equality in members in debate. Members must not be permitted by their conduct to deny to others that which they claim for themselves. Language used by members during the debate should be temperate, decorous, and respectful. So that same rules are going to be applied to everybody always in this committee, and I just want to remind everybody of that today, now and moving forward. It's a little bit interesting, you know, the rules don't actually tell you what the consequences are, but if I can't trust you all to follow the rules, then you're not going to have the privileges that you are afforded by the rules. So that, as I said, that will be applied to everyone. So thank you. Moving on, does look like we definitely have full house today, so we'll move on to the minutes. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes of January 24th, 2023?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Moeller moves the minutes of January 24th. Any discussion to the minutes? All right, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The minutes are approved. All right. First on the agenda today, Representative Olson. I will move that House File 19 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Olson, I understand that you have a technical amendment. Would you like us to move that amendment?
Yes, please, Madam Chair.
All right. I will move the A11 amendment to House File 19. Representative Olson, would you like us to just pass the amendment and then you can explain it?
Okay. That would be great, Madam Chair.
All right. So moving the A11 amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author would like. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right. Representative Olson, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the Judiciary Committee. So Minnesotans care for one another, and we want Minnesota to be a caring state where all our families can be healthy and safe. So I'm bringing this bill up today because we all know that everyone gets sick, and the pandemic was another reminder that when people get sick, they should be able to stay home, not just for their own health or that of a loved one, but for the health of all of us. This bill would ensure Minnesota is a state where, regardless of the color of your skin, your income, or where you work, you can be there when your sick child needs you, where you can go to a doctor before your illness goes from bad to worse, where you can take the time to recover from an illness or seek support in the wake of a sexual assault without worrying about missing bills or losing your job. Unfortunately, for far too many, especially those we called essential during the pandemic, this isn't the Minnesota they experience. An estimated 36% of working people, that's 932,000 Minnesotans, don't have any paid sick and safe time. This means that in a state with the second most Fortune 500 companies per capita, more than a third of working people in our state face a terrible choice between caring for themselves or loved ones in need and the loss of wages or even employment, because in many circumstances, it is still legal for workers to be fired for needing to take time off to care for themselves or a loved one. And this is also a public health issue. Since many of the employees least likely to have paid sick time work in jobs such as food service, we're choosing to come in and work on the same side of the sneeze guard as your food, all because they need that paycheck, can have real health implications for the general public. Earned sick and safe time also results in higher productivity, fewer workplace injuries, and a healthier Minnesota with businesses that provide sick and safe reporting, less employee turnover, meaning lower training costs, less spreading of illness to customers or even other coworkers, meaning less absenteeism, lower employee health care costs through better use of preventative care, and lower presenteeism for coming to work sick. And for small businesses, this legislation also levels the playing field. Many businesses offer paid sick days throughout Minnesota because they know it's the right thing to do for their employees, their customers, and their communities. But those small businesses are often competing with big box stores and large out-of-state employers that haven't offered the same benefit, all while reaping record profits during the pandemic. This bill levels the playing field by ensuring that all employers provide the basic standard to their Minnesota workers. And now to the committee's jurisdiction today. We are looking at enforcement provisions in Article 2, starting on page 12 of the bill, and the judicial appropriation lines on 2.12 through 2.14 of the author's amendment. Specifically, sections 1 and 3 increase the maximum penalties, and I just note the language of up to preceding both for the refusal to turn over records and for repeated and willful violations for employers who are either knowingly breaking the law because they've been previously caught doing it and were told to correct their action but didn't, again, the repeated, or employers who are intentionally violating the law, i.e. they're willingly taking their workers' sick time pay. These changes give DLI increased flexibility to address those cases where they are being stonewalled or where the existing civil penalties are clearly insufficient. And I just want to be clear, this increased maximum does not apply to a failure to keep records, but covers the willful refusal to provide records at DLI's request. Because refusing to turn over records that may show a violation of the law should not stand as a valid defense against DLI investigating a complaint and getting relief for workers. In addition, both existing statutes prevent DLI from levying a penalty that will result in business hardship and limit maximum penalties to the most egregious cases. And in practice, DLI very rarely issues any administrative penalty at all because their primary concern is correcting the action and getting restitution for any affected workers. This means that when DLI finds a problem, they start with a compliance order, not a penalty, and try to get the employer to voluntarily correct the problem. And according to DLI in the fiscal note, on average, the department assessed and collected a penalty in 1.9% of all investigations. So next, within this committee's jurisdiction in Section 2 applies DLI existing compliance order authority to sick and safe time, and Section 5 replaces the existing sick time private right of action with this new statutory reference, while Section 4, Subdivision 3 clarifies the time limit on bringing such actions. And as for the judicial appropriation, Article 3, as amended by lines 2.12 through 2.14 of my author's amendment today, it includes $1,000 in fiscal year 24 for printing costs to meet the notice and posting requirements at 100 court locations, plus $494,000 in fiscal year 25 with an ongoing base of $461,000 for one additional district court judge, court reporter, and law clerk for possible private right of action. And with that, I believe I have covered all of the bill sections within the purview of this committee, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Olson. We didn't have anyone sign up to testify. I know this bill is going through multiple committees, but if are there any members of the public who would wish to testify on this bill? All right. Not seeing any. I believe you've got someone on hand if there are questions, but we'll move on to member discussion. Any discussion, House File 19? Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn, Representative Olson, going through this, I see there's penalties if the employer inadvertently passes on information about the request for leave or why they're gone. But I know in small business, small employers and businesses, even in where I worked in the for the county as the sheriff in the sheriff's office, we'd have people take leave for one reason or another. Are the supervisors and the sheriff and stuff would not tell us, but the employees would find out anyway. Is it for that penalty for civil action if information gets out, is that going to be up to the employer to prove that he didn't, or is that going to be up to Dolly to prove that that the employer did pass on that information and get the fine?
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do have DLI on, and I, will you point to the section of the bill specifically tying the record, the sharing of the information with the penalty part? Because I know we covered the section about, like, willfully withholding documents or intentionally withholding documents, not turning them over, and the section about if you willfully and repeatedly violate a part of this bill. But could you tell me exactly where you see the tie between the two? That may help myself and the DLI commissioner.
Representative Johnson.
I'm Chair Becker Finn, Representative. I'll have to find it again. I was reading it last night and I forgot my notes. Maybe House Research might know as well. I'll be looking for it.
All right. I don't know. DLI wants to, maybe you know.
And Chair Becker Finn, and there just may be a confusion between the record keeping section and the, and that's what I'm trying to get clarity around. If you're just asking about the fees and retaliation, or if you're asking about the specific private data part of it.
Got it. If you could introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nicole Blissenbach, and I am the Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry. I'm not entirely sure what portion Representative is speaking to. The penalty authority that is provided to the Department of Labor and Industry is in the areas already identified by Representative Olson. It's for failure to provide records to the department after the department makes a demand, and for failure to comply after there has been a repeated or willful violation.
Representative Johnson, any follow-up?
Not at this time, but see if I can find that slide again.
All right. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was curious about, to dig in a little bit further with the department about the records requests, provisions and penalties. How many, I'm curious, how many times does the department request records from employees every year for violations of Chapter 177, if you know?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I don't know off the top of my head how many demands for records we make in a year. I could find that out. But typically, demands for records occur after we receive a complaint from an employee that their rights under Chapter 177 have been violated, and we're investigating that complaint, or if we have reason to believe that there is a violation of Chapter 177 or Chapter 181, anything under our authority, we would make that demand for records in order to look into whether there actually has been a violation.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, do you know how many times, say in the last 4 years, that the department has fined a business for failing to submit records under Chapter 177?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm not sure of the exact number, as Representative Olson stated, and is in our fiscal note, we do issue penalties in approximately 1.9% of investigations that the department conducts.
Any follow-up, Representative Niska?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. How often does the department fine a business because the manner that they submitted the records doesn't comply with the section, if you know?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm, again, not entirely sure the number, but if an employer submits the records that we are requesting, even if the records are not in order or if they're not in the manner in which we are requesting them, sometimes we will work with the employer to get them in a manner that is easier for us to look through. But we would typically follow up with another request. We would penalize when we're not receiving the records that we've requested.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess based on your description, I'm curious what the rationale is for a 900% increase in the potential penalty And also curious whether this applies beyond just the earned safe and sick time provisions that we're talking about in this bill.
Represent Olson or Commissioner, whoever wants to take that one.
Can Madam Chair, I know the Commissioner will say, and I think just to be super clear in what we've worked with DLI on is like, the goal is not to penalize, the goal is to get compliance so that every worker in our state can have earned sick and safe time. We don't want the retaliation, you know, we don't want all of the things in here to be happening. That's why we have an up to a maximum for repeated and willful violation. We want people to have earned sick and safe time. And this, so I think refocusing on to that part is kind of a good way to shift the conversation, but I will let the Commissioner answer the
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I can just reiterate that. The goal of penalties is, it's two-part. One, it's to deter the behavior that from violating the law to begin with, but then also it allows the department to look at a case when we have it to see if there is egregious behavior to make sure that we are being able to recoup the benefit that is entitled to the employee that is required under law. And our goal is never to just penalize. Our goal is to recoup that benefit that is there, that is provided to the employee under law, which is why we are issuing penalties in only 1.9% of cases.
Last follow-up, Representative Nisga.
This is actually a slightly different line of questioning, if that's all right, Madam Chair. And this is, I think, more for the bill author, and it has to do with the fiscal note and the appropriation we're giving to the judicial system here. It assumes a pretty significant increase in the number of cases filed in district court, enough to justify an increase of one judge unit across the state. And my question is, has there been any modeling done that's going to help us to understand, as a result of that increase in private lawsuits, what the transfer of wealth is going to be from, as a result of this, from the small business community of Minnesota to the legal industry in Minnesota?
Representative Olson.
Well, I think you're on the fiscal note. It's page 11, and it talks about, so there is an increase in the employment law cases because of the sick and safe time private actions. I do want to note that we learned a lot from what happened in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Duluth, and Bloomington around it, but I don't necessarily see that part of the fiscal note has reflected some of those learnings, and I think the more we implement this, we learn, and the fiscal note gets a little bit better every year, right, because we learn about these. But it's really, I would say that assumption, I think you actually hit it on the head, isn't really based on what we've learned, which we aren't seeing as much of that happening in the places where earned sick and safe time have been implemented.
And I thank you for pointing us to the right page. I mean, it also doesn't say anything specifically that it's going to just be small businesses. I mean, these could be very large businesses, correct? Follow-up, Representative Nisga. Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a comment and just a really specific technical question. As a small business owner, I have a law firm, I have 10 employees. I'm always trying to understand what the needs of my employees are, how best to incentivize them to stay, to work their hardest. And I think this is a really important bill, and I thank you for bringing it. My technical question, just in terms of how this would impact me, is how I know that this would not supersede more generous policies, but I'm curious how it interacts with PTO. I'm assuming it is separate and apart from PTO because earned sick and safe time is conceptually different, but I just wanted to clarify that. Thank you.
Representative Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Feist. And I will note, because we're in judiciary, we didn't kind of bring the business owner perspective to this committee, but we have seen small businesses. I'm from Duluth, and we have had them testify and support and submit letters, and it really is, they say that this was a reason a lot of them are actually able to get through the pandemic and weather it, because we had earned sick and safe time. So for small business owners, and just to comment on that, to your point, this is tracking to make sure, like, if an employer has a policy that meets these standards or is better than this, that would satisfy the requirements of earned sick and safe time.
Thank you. Any follow-up, Representative Feist?
Yep, thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, so PTO is different than sick and safe time, correct? So if an employer provides a very generous PTO policy, this would still be separate from that. Is that correct?
Represent Volson.
Well, if the PTO meets the requirements for earned sick and safe time, it would satisfy this.
Okay.
All right, and Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious to the bill's author, because Minneapolis, Duluth, I think there's one other city that has a law similar to this, or an ordinance, I guess it would be on a city level. Why did you choose just having one employee? That's a smaller amount than any of the other cities, and it just seems really difficult for small employers.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good question, Representative Scott. So we have learned that, for example, in St. Paul last week, they actually walked back any carve-outs they had, and they're actually trying to expand the universe of businesses because we're seeing that this benefit, the sky has not fallen in places where we've had really made sure to try to capture all levels of employment, because it doesn't matter if you have one or 50 people. People get sick. And need to have this benefit. So our goal is to cover as many people as possible, and we're seeing that that is exactly where others are trying to go that haven't had as generous or have had carve-outs are actually walking them back because this is a benefit that we want to make sure everyone in our community has, regardless if you work at an employer that employs five people or an employer that employs 500.
Representative Scott, any follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. My concern is that you have one or two or, you know, even less than five employees, just having one person gone, especially in today's labor market, and I'm just fearful that there won't be a job left because those small businesses may not be able to afford to have that large of a percentage of their folks missing and afford these benefits. I'm wondering how, and I think the bill talks about it a little bit, but how does this bill interact with current policies of Duluth and Minneapolis?
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think in the scenario you laid out with the one employer too, I mean, the alternative is someone's coming to work really sick or they're not, you know, I mean, like, we also don't want that, right? I don't think as a small business owner, you would want someone coming in and working in a really having COVID or in a sick state, right? So I think you also need to think about the inverse if we don't offer this benefit and the damage it does to employers and everybody around that person. And in terms of, so we've learned a lot from Duluth, St. Paul, Minneapolis, Bloomington, and other states that have passed it. So this tracks closely on those. And for example, to your question about the one employee, St. Paul has passed or is in the middle of passing to cover down to one employee. So it continues to even track more closely with the legislation we have here. And this again is the floor. So if there are more generous places out there, they can go above what we are putting forward in this legislation.
Representative Scott.
One final question. Thank you, Madam Chair. Why not put some sort of a waiting period? I think these benefits kick in after, is it 80 hours with the employer? You mentioned, we have a lot of Fortune 500 companies here, and most of them have this benefit, and maybe it's PTO or whatever, but it just seems like, you know, there's a 90-day waiting period, even a 60-day waiting period. I'm just wondering why right out of the chute, foreseeably a full-time employee could, you know, just have worked 2 weeks and get this benefit, and I just wondered why. It just seems really harsh.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Scott. So if you're working full time and you're accruing at 1 hour per 30 hours a week, you would have to work 6 weeks, I believe, before you would even be eligible for one day. So the accrual, even though we want this benefit to start getting accrued. Sorry, lost my train of thought. that we want the benefit to start being accrued immediately and be able to use as soon as you have an increment big enough to use it. But again, to put that in perspective, you would work full time for 6 weeks before you'd even be able to take a day off.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Olson. I know with my employees, we're, you know, I, it's a service job where people, most people aren't working 40 hours a week. You know, the amount of time it takes to accrue a significant amount. It takes a while to get there if you're working 15, 20 hours a week for a lot of small businesses that operate that way. So seeing no further discussion. Representative Johnson.
Chair Beckerpin, Representative Oakley. Finally, I believe I found it. It's on 9.23 where the information is given. And then on 10.1, it talks about the non-discrimination based on the records created for the purpose. And it referenced the new statute where it goes to 14.8, individual remedies, where it can create lawsuits after 3 years. I'm wondering how it works if the employee thinks the employer did something. Is it going to be Dolly that has to prove it was, or the information does leak out eventually? And so I'm trying to make it so it's a little tighter, so we don't have as many lawsuits on this.
Commissioner or representative? All right, Commissioner.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. I do see where you're pointing to, where it does say that information given by an employee may only be disclosed by an employer if consented by the employee. So that would be a requirement that the employer cannot disclose that private information that the employee is provided for as the reason for taking leave. So that would be a requirement that, if violated by the employer, could it result in an investigation? And if there is a violation found, that is the purpose of an investigation that we would have at DLI, just like other investigations related to retaliation. You know, did retaliation actually happen? Was there a violation of the rights or benefits that are provided in the statute? So that is something we could determine. What would have to be shown is that the employer released the information that is protected by this provision of the bill.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Beckerpin, Representative Olson. I think that needs to be tightened up a little bit to make sure it's clear and convincing, because I know in where I worked, and even at some other places, you know why the person's out on leave. Everybody does, even though the employer did not say anything. Because word does travel, people know the person, they understand it, and they're friends, so they understand it. But we need to get something that's show that it's clear and convincing that the employer actually leaked that information. It might be different in a business with 1,500 employees, but when you get down to businesses with 1, 10, 15, they know everybody. And it's really easy to find out what's going on, and this is setting up to have the employer being sued and being run out of business.
All right. So wrapping up discussion, Representative Olson, any closing comments before we move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for the discussion. And I think this bill is, we've went through a pandemic. There are people that still could get fired for being sick, that have to go to work sick. And I think we all know stories of those folks. And so it's time we get this passed, and I really appreciate the committee hearing this.
All right, I will renew my motion that House File 19 as amended be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to your committee, Chair Olson. All right, next on the agenda, we've got House File 45, Representative Feist. Representative Feist, would you like to move that House File 45 be recommended to be placed on the general register?
Yes, Madam Chair, that is my motion.
All right. Please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I had the honor to carry the Veterans Restorative Justice Act in 2021 when it passed into law with bipartisan support. At that time, I quoted the wife of one of the veterans eligible for restorative sentencing under this new law. She said, "I am not a victim. I am a proud wife of a man that honorably served his country for 22 years. I'm happy to report that this veteran recently graduated from Ramsey Veterans Court. On graduation, he wrote an email to his attorney saying, 'You truly gave me my life back. I'm truly grateful that all of this happened because I got the help I needed, and I'm happier than I have ever been. I got to meet and help a few vets along the way, too.' Since 2021, many, many other veterans statewide have responded to the incentives created by the Veterans Restorative Justice Act to receive desperately needed support and treatment for post-traumatic stress and addiction, domestic violence intervention, and professional mentorship. The bill I'm presenting today does not make any substantive change to the Veterans Restorative Justice Act. Rather, it provides clarification on the order of proceedings, which some, but not all, courts have found confusing. Specifically, the language clarifies that if veterans can demonstrate a nexus between a service-related trauma or injury and the act that landed them in court, then at that point, they can choose a restorative sentencing path. They are not required to enter a plea before doing so. This is an important clarification because it eliminates the procedural confusion that creates additional burdens on the courts due to the uncertainty created in the plea process. And I'd like to note also that the County Attorneys Association has supported this bill. They didn't get a letter in time, but they did provide a letter. And
All right, and I see that you do have a testifier. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Ryan Else, E-L-S-E. I am a private criminal defense lawyer and a policy attorney with the Veterans Defense Project. I brought this issue to Representative Feist's attention about the middle of the year because we have been hearing problems in the courts with the eligibility determination coming after the plea. It causes just a practical problem of if the veteran enters a plea and then is denied eligibility, they're basically in the situation of a straight plea. It makes plea negotiation very cumbersome and difficult. Really just keeps everybody in the dark for too long. By moving the eligibility determination to the front end, everybody in the court process knows what they're dealing with and what sentences are available. I've had many veterans sentenced under this bill, and I can tell you it's doing really great work. I could share a bunch of stories, but I won't take your time.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone from the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right. Not seeing anyone. We do have, before we move on to member discussion, we do have an amendment. I believe it's a Representative Weens. Is this your amendment, and would you like to move it?
Yes, Chair Becker-Finn, I would.
All right. Representative Weens moves the A1 amendment. Please tell us about your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Feist. First of all, I'd like to thank Representative Feist for being available to discuss the opportunity to add, I think, some metrics of support. I'm extremely supportive of all initiatives such as this, and I think this is an innovative initiative for our veterans that are suffering from PTS, mental or chemical issues that are connected to their service. It's so important that I think we need to be able to track it. And one of the things that we've discussed is the bill's lack of accountability or some kind of mechanism by which we can see the progress. And that is in order to improve and expand it. The A1 amendment does this by requiring the courts to report the information about deferred prosecutions to the Sentencing Guideline Commission, then summarizes the data and submits a report to the legislature. I ran this language past the courts, and they will need to make some tweaks. Hence, in order today not to delay the forward movement of this important bill, HF 45, I withdraw my amendment. My desire was to share this development and with the committee for discussion and furtherance. I will continue to work with Representative Feist in the courts to narrow that language so we can achieve what I think is important, and that is a mechanism by where we can see success and where we need to make change, we can make change. And I thank you for working with me, Representative Feist. And I yield you, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Weens withdraws the A1 amendment. No other amendments before us. Members, discussion to the bill. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. In all of this, anytime we do a bill similar to this, and I'm supportive of the underlying everything, right? But are the victims notified in this? I think we always have to keep the victims at the fore of our minds. So if the author or the testifier can address that, are they notified of the outcomes of this?
Representative Feist.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll mostly turn it over to my expert, but I just wanted to confirm that they very much are part of this process. And in working on this bill in 2021 when it passed, that was something that we were really conscious of and worked across the aisle to make sure that this bill reflected support for victims and making sure that they were part of the process, which is so important for restorative justice in general. And for technical answer, I will turn it over to Mr. Else.
Mr. Else.
The bill that this is correcting and that doesn't change this process has a whole new structure to it that adds an extra layer of victim protection than is available really in any other court context, because there's an end of supervision hearing that the judge holds, and the victim has a right to notice and appearance and testimony at that hearing. And if the judge decides that the harm to the victim outweighs the rehabilitative measures that the veteran has taken, they don't get the benefit of the dismissal. There's nowhere else in Minnesota law that exists. So this actually goes above and beyond in protecting victims.
Right. Follow-up, Representative Scott.
Thank you for that answer, and Chair Becker-Finn. And this is kind of related to that, but I would encourage members, if you've never sat in on a veterans court, to do so. It is one of the things that, as a citizen, makes you really, really proud just the thankfulness that these veterans show for people coming alongside them. So it's kind of related, Madam Chair, but if you've never sat in on a veterans court, please do so.
Being able to do more things in person this biennium, I am hoping that at some point we will be have some field trip opportunities. There are all kinds of specialty courts that function in all kinds of different ways for different populations of people. And I do think that it is very instructive to actually sit in and observe some of those hearings if you can. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Feist, I would be interested in hearing your thoughts or comments on the approach Representative Weens proposed, and what you think the prospects and challenges are of maybe setting up some sort of additional data collection or something that might help inform us in the future.
Representative Feist.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. I love data. So I fully support Representative Weens in wanting to create some ability to collect information about outcomes. I think it just informs us as the legislature, it informs the courts, and it helps us to make sure that we have efficient, effective, just systems of justice. And I know that the courts have a lot of thoughts on kind of the practical implementation of this type of data collection, and I'm super excited to work with Representative Weens and the courts to find a way to do that type of data collection. In the context of the Veterans Restorative Justice Act, I think that there's this additional layer of trickiness, because this isn't exclusive to veterans treatment courts. It's a broader framework that gives veterans treatment court-esque options across the state of Minnesota. And so I think when we're creating a data collection, if we want it to be specific to Veterans Restorative Justice Act, there's just this other layer of complexity in how we structure that data collection.
I'll just remind folks that the A1 is no longer before us. Certainly willing, if there's another bill that comes forward on this, we can discuss it more in depth at that time. Any further discussion to House File 45? All right. Representative Feist, closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Veterans Restorative Justice Act has done so much good for veterans in the state of Minnesota. This will just clarify the order of proceedings, making it clear for courts and veterans, and I would urge your support.
All right. Seeing no further discussion, Representative Feist will renew her motion to recommend that House File 45 be placed on the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. All right. Thank you. All right. That's you, Mr. Vice Chair. All right, the last bill on our agenda today is House File 28. This is a Vice Chair Frazier bill. Vice Chair Frazier, would you like to move to re-refer House File 28 to the Committee on Ways and Means?
That is my motion, Madam Chair. Thank you.
And then I understand that you do have an A5 amendment. Would you like to move the A5 amendment?
I would, Madam Chair.
All right. We're going to move the A5 to get the bill in the shape the author would like. All those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Vice Chair Frazier, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll tell you a bit about the amendment. Essentially what it does, it lines it up with the Senate companion bill that is moving forward. So in Section 1, it replaces language, which was suggested by nonpartisan counsel, clarifying those convicted of a felony have their right to vote restored whenever they are not incarcerated, without implying that they necessarily lose it between conviction and sentencing. It also adds language to the Voters' Bill of Rights. It also clarifies that individuals can register to vote online or by returning their voter registration application to their county auditor, and then it adds an appropriation to the Secretary of State's office so they can make the needed changes to paper and online forms, including costs of translating those updated materials. And that's an increase of $1,000 for that amount.
All right. You want to go ahead and present the bill, and I know we've got quite a few testifiers today, and we're hopefully in good shape. We can get everybody in, so
I'll
go ahead.
Be brief. So, Madam Chair, committee members, the cornerstone of our democracy is the right to vote. That right allows for an individual to let their voice be heard. House File 28 will restore the right to vote back to individuals that have been convicted of a felony but are no longer incarcerated. Currently, over 55,000 Minnesotans are without a voice in our democracy. That represents 1.3% of the state's voting eligible population. And because we know about the disparities in our state, people of color are disproportionately impacted, with black Minnesotans disenfranchised at over four times the state rate. And Latinx Minnesotans are disenfranchised at nearly twice the state rate. These are mothers, fathers, sons, daughters, sisters, brothers, and our neighbors who are living in the community, working to provide for their families, paying their taxes, and contributing to our state. They are people that have valuable insights and have proximity to the most pressing issues in their communities throughout Minnesota. Yet, because of a conviction in their past, these same people are still denied their fundamental right to vote. We should seek responses to crime that do not simply punish, but also rehabilitate, heal, and restore. Not allowing the right to vote to those we have deemed safe to reenter the community does not further a criminal justice purpose. Restoring voting rights to those convicted of a felony crime but no longer incarcerated is one of the ways to help facilitate reintegration into the community by giving these individuals their voice to participate in the electoral process. Currently in this state, our government cannot truly be reflective and representative of all its people if certain voices continue to be shut out of the process. And it is well time to correct this issue. Madam Chair, with that, I will yield to testifiers.
All right. First on the list, I've got Zeke Caliguri, and then I've got Dr. Chris Eugen on deck. Welcome to the committee. I just ask that testifiers be mindful. We've got several people who'd like to testify, so if you can get to the point, we would all appreciate it. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Zeke Caliguri. I do a community outreach and education with the Minnesota Justice Research Center. I am a homecomer after 22 years of incarceration. I spent that time in a cell or a cage or however you choose to conceptualize the small spaces we've made for people that we typically feel we're afraid of. I'm also an author, a college graduate. As an incarcerated person, I worked to support a similar version of this bill in 2015. I've worked on a campaign in 2016 encouraging families of the incarcerated to vote because their loved ones could not. This last fall, I worked with the Minnesota Justice Research Center in partnership with other formerly incarcerated people and organizations to engage and support civic participation and voter turnout for newly re-enfranchised voters. I do this because my humanity matters to me. Most of the world stays relatively detached from what a prison cell feels like and the kind of personal agency and resilience it takes to push through the challenges of transforming into an entire human being. The human beings that are here today and that will speak are taxpayers, their fathers and mothers. We count amongst us teachers, clergy, professors, and some, like former Representative Ray Dean, have even served alongside of you. Some of our community can't be here because they work in factories to help put their kids through college, because that's their investment in their own lives and in their communities. We care about the safety in our neighborhoods because we live in those neighborhoods, right? And understand the harm and destruction of violence in those communities. That's why we show up, because we know what a cell feels like, while also being counted in districts that don't represent us. Instead, someone else created an entire industry making sure a punishment model for all our social problems becomes so embedded in our cultural psyche that it becomes difficult to break from its carceral patterns. Every year, new legislation comes through that affects their humanity. They watch as their worlds and opportunities shrink. We've never adequately supported people in those places and people coming out of those institutions. But I would say that one of the great secrets is that part of dehumanizing a person also leaves those responsible to enforce the dehumanization dehumanized as well. House File 28 and corresponding Senate File 26 is about making something permissible in this state that should never have been impermissible in the past. Voting rights have always been about the recognition and counting of an individual's humanity. And after all that, my humanity is sitting right here in front of you. Those still living in cages aren't able to show you their faces or their scars or the open wounds still injuring their lives. There's nothing partisan about wanting to be represented by those brokering power in our lives and in our communities. The last time I sat in front of a congressional committee, I spoke about my own personal liberation in spirit, in thought, and in action. Know that we, as justice-impacted individuals, have had to liberate ourselves. So as a community, we had to build the bridges. We motivated each other and uplifted each other. This is Minnesota's chance to show it values the liberation and uplift we've created for ourselves, and that it understands that in order for Minnesota to be liberated, it has to count the humanity of all of its people. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, I have Dr. Chris Eugen. And then on deck, I've got Minister Janae Bates. Please introduce please introduce yourself and proceed.
Well, good morning. My name is Chris Eugen. I'm a longtime University of Minnesota faculty member, 27 years now, and author of a book on disenfranchisement with Oxford University Press. I speak in favor of the bill. Since 2016, eight states have now restored the right to non-incarcerated people. So Minnesota has slipped from kind of the middle of the pack among the 50 states to one of the more restrictive states. As a criminologist, I see voting as well aligned with the goals of community supervision. So what would the bill do? It would extend civil rights to about 48,000 Minnesotans living and working in every county in the state. It would support racial justice in ballot access so that punishment disparities don't echo outward to create voting disparities. This bill would restore voting rights to over 4% of the Black and American Indian voting age populations in our state. It would also respond to public opinion, which generally favors reenfranchisement for people on probation and on parole. And this is the standard in half the states now and almost every nation. It would also reduce confusion about eligibility and eliminate unlawful voting charges against people who are doing well on supervision. They might have been doing well for 10 years and catch a new felony for illegal voting. It's also fair. Right now, people who are on probation are often disenfranchised far longer than people who do their time in incarcerated. And I'd also like to speak to the public safety issue, that indeed voting does support the reintegrative goals of community supervision. Voters are much less likely to be arrested. They're much more likely to successfully complete probation and parole in states like Oregon, where they are permitted to vote. And they're less likely to commit new crimes upon release from prison. There's absolutely no evidence that expanding voting rights would lead to greater crime. So I thank you very much for your attention to the social science research on this question.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Next, I have Minister Janae Bates, and then I have Wintana Melikin on deck. Welcome. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. My name is Minister Janae Bates. I am the Communications Director with ISAIAH, and I am grateful to be before you. I'm also the Associate Minister at Camphor Memorial United Methodist Church in St. Paul. But I'm not here actually on behalf of myself. I'm here on behalf of this gentleman. This man's name is Dantes. He is currently incarcerated and has been for the last 17 years, his entire adult life. And in that time, he has spent a remarkable amount of energy and time rehabilitating himself and getting to a place of liberation through personal development, professional development, and doing so for other men where he's incarcerated. In that 17 years, he developed a program that 250 men have gone through that is about restorative justice in practice, but also how to have healthy interpersonal relationships and how to be completely human and loving and caring. It's what we expect from people. Now, he and I, we both grew up in Ohio, and in Ohio, it is a state that has a different legislative makeup. It actually has a Republican governor, Senate, and House. And in that, they have chosen to allow this man, Dantes, to be able to vote when he is released from prison. I say that because it is very clear that it is regardless of if you have a D or an R on your title, this is actually about just recognizing someone's full humanity. This man is also my husband. And as my husband, he will get to live right here in Minnesota when he's released. And it is about recognizing his full humanity, that when he comes home to Minnesota, he can have a say about the community he lives in. I ask that you vote according to that, believing that this person is a full person who deserves to have a say and engagement in his community. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, I have Wintana Melikin, and then I have Sandy Yancey on deck. All right, Sandy Yancey, we will skip ahead to that person if they're present. All right, Joseph Milton, Jay Lindgren. All right, we got one.
You should have seen the graphic on Interstate 94 today.
Yeah, I know one of our members was delayed for that reason as well. So thank you for being here. Please introduce yourself for the committee and then proceed with your testimony.
Chair, Vice Chair, House Lead. My name is Jay Lindgren, and I want to thank you for this opportunity. I live in St. Louis Park. I'm a volunteer leader in Faith in Minnesota, and We Choose Us. I have voted in every election since I turned the legal age over 60 years ago. I come to you in support of this bill. I strongly urge you to restore the vote for our convicted persons who are our neighbors. I spent 50 years working in corrections in Minnesota, Texas, and Rhode Island. That experience taught me that individuals who commit so-called street crimes believe they have little stake in civil society. Disenfranchisement only amplifies that belief. Each of us has good habits and bad habits. I want voting to become every citizen's good habit. Bad habits in the form of addiction to drugs or alcohol or criminal acts can be difficult to break. We have known for decades that the younger an individual is when he or she commits that first crime, the greater the risk of a second crime. We know that an individual who has committed one serious crime is less likely to commit another crime in the future than one who has committed much less serious crimes. Therefore, I think this should be universally applied, regardless of the serious crime that got the person in trouble in the first place. I want to quickly add that I am delighted by the symmetry I see between this bill and House File 110. That bill allows pre-registration of 16 and 17-year-old youth that will promote the development of the good habit of voting beginning at age 18. Two bills that promote the good habit of voting will strengthen the democracy and help reduce recidivism. Thank you for listening. I respectfully beseech you to pass this bill.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Next on the list, I have former Representative Ray Dean. My first term, I got to serve on public safety with Representative Dean. So please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony. And now have your seat on the floor, too.
Well, good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. It's always good to be back here. I haven't been in the basement of the state office building for quite some time. My name is Raymond Dean, and I'm going to tell you why this matters to me. But first, I want to remind you that 1 in 4 people have a criminal record in America. It's 1 in 4. So chances are you know someone who does. And I also like to add that almost all of us, at some point in our youth, committed a crime. We may not have gotten caught, but we committed a crime. I know many people live out in rural parts of the state that talk about, yeah, there was that one night we went out with a baseball bat and knocked down a bunch of mailboxes. Well, that's a crime. And if you'd gotten caught, you probably would have had a felony. My conviction was in 1976. I ended up serving 7 months. I was released from probation early, and I thought that I had lost my right to vote forever. That's pretty much common on anyone who's been convicted of felony, that they believe they will never have a right to vote again. So I applied for a pardon in 1981, and I received that pardon. I received that pardon, I believe, because I did a lot of things and pretty much everything right that was asked of me. And I also believe I received that pardon because I'm white. But what I want to remind folks is there's roughly 50,000 people now that will have the right to vote. And we know that people that participate civically that have had past criminal records are less likely to reoffend. So fundamentally, we talk about this bill a lot as an elections bill, but it's also a public safety bill. And that's a way that I think we need to begin to think about this. I've heard lots of talk about this bill. Well, it has to be bipartisan. It has to be bipartisan. It has to be bipartisan. And, you know, every term I was in office, there were Republican co-authors on my bill. There was a time I served on public safety in the minority, and that public safety chair actually carried this bill. So this is bipartisan. I just want to speak to, I guess, something. Dr. Uggans referenced the states that have passed re-enfranchisement since 2016, and states like Ohio now, you know, prior to 14, states like Indiana, Utah, and North Dakota. Clearly, these are not the progressive bastions of the United States that we think about. These are people that understand the importance of making sure that people are voting, participating, and enfranchising them into society. I think lastly about why someone would oppose this. And I struggle because all evidence shows that this increases public safety. So for those of you who support this because you believe in punitive measures for individuals that have done wrong, I just want you to stop and think about what do you prioritize more, punishing people or making our communities safer? Because in the end, that's the decision that you all will make when you vote on this bill. So I'm going to make sure that I have plenty of other people that have time to testify. But again, thank you all, and I encourage you all to support House File 28.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, I have Munira Mohammed. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Hello to the committee and hello to the chair. My name is Munira Mohammed. I'm the policy associate for the ACLU Minnesota. That's the American Civil Liberties Union. We are here to speak in support of House File 28 regarding the restoration of civil right to vote. It's clear the ability to choose your government is at the core nature of a democracy. But today we have a situation where thousands of Minnesotans who live in our communities, who work, raise families, pay taxes, they are barred from the most basic form of civic engagement, voting. 55,000 Minnesotans have been released from prison, are still denied the right to vote. This is made even more egregious when we take into consideration Minnesota's history and pattern of trapping individuals in decades-long probation and supervision sentences. It's an incredible travesty that finishing your sentence and becoming part of the community isn't enough to show that one has paid their due to society. In fact, the state continues to punish you and those who have been to prison with massive disenfranchisement. If the goal is to truly rehabilitate people and have them become part of society again, then we need them to have a voice and the ability to fully participate in civic life. The ACLU of Minnesota has advocated on this issue for several years now in the Capitol, in the courts, and in the community. As you know, we have ongoing lawsuit on this issue. We are grateful to this committee for hearing this bill and urge you to pass it. Thank you to the chair and members.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Last on the list today, I have Tom Evanstead. All right, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, Rep. Frazier, members of the committee. My name is Tom Evanstead, E-V-E-N-S-T-A-D, and I testify today in very strong support of this bill, and I appreciate the opportunity to briefly share my personal story that relates to this bill. Yesterday, I testified at the recreational cannabis bill hearing that at age 17, the state made a cannabis criminal out of me, and due to the 152.18 disposition, I was unable to vote in my first election. In 1998, I was wrongfully convicted of rape by the state and sent to prison for a decade for a crime that never happened. Upon release in 2008, it took another 5 years before I was allowed to vote again. Minnesota canceled me at the ballot box for 15 years by weaponizing the criminal system against me. In addition to preventing me from having any say in who governs me, including the very people who harmed me and my father, most specifically irreparably, I was prevented from being eligible to run for office to help people in Minnesota by prioritizing people over politics and money. In 2013, when I finally got my voting rights restored, I announced at the medical cannabis hearing my intention to run for governor against Mark Dayton. Ironically, Tony Cornish and Dan Shaun mocked me, and we all know what happened there. Anyway, within 2 weeks of my announcement, I was framed all over again, this time with the state weaponizing the flawed stalking statutes to frame me as a stalker to prevent me not only from following my higher calling to serve, but also to punish me with jailing to intimidate, punish, and disincentivize me from ever trying to run for office again. After being brutally and violently coerced into, you know, tapping out, they call it, agreeing to a plea agreement based on the conditions that you face in jails as a pretrial detainee. In Bob Fletcher's jail, I was subjected to 20 years of probation against threat of decades in prison from the malicious prosecution. I'm 10 years into my probation, despite the Sentencing Guidelines Commission limiting probation terms to 5 years, and I have another 10 to go if the state has their way. So that means since 2013, when I regained my voting rights after 15 years, I've gone another 10 years and counting, being silenced and disenfranchised. And to wrap up, 25 years of cancellation to date, and the state wants to make it 35 years without my right to vote, due solely to the perpetration of state crimes against me. Arguably, there is no one in the state of Minnesota who is more disenfranchised than I am, and this bill is both a way to help reintegrate actual criminals, restore my enshrined First Amendment right, and prevent the state from ever being able to make a political prisoner again. Thank you, and God bless.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else from the public wishing to testify on this bill? Please come forward. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Co-Chair. Good morning. My name is Patrick Maxson. And I thank you for the opportunity to speak here today. I'm currently an organizer with the New Justice Project Minnesota. I'm also a person with a felony conviction in my past. I'm a recovering addict and formerly homeless. I must also accept my responsibility to do everything within my power every day to remain sober, to live within the law, and most importantly, to work and repair the community. That is why I'm here to testify today. Through grace and community support, I am grateful and enlightened, transformed man. I get a chance to be human. At one point in my life, I was on probation following my release from prison. Probation was designed as a stipulation that is supposed to help and make sure a man or woman stays on track with developing as an active citizen and productive member of society. It is designed to bring people back into community, not exclude them from it. Voting is not only a human right, but some would say an American responsibility. And taxation without representation is not right. If I'm integrated and have served my time, then I should be able to effectively participate in the structure, in this structure of democracy. If I'm released to parent, to attend church, to work, to pay taxes, and be responsible for bills, to walk down the same streets, to testify at the state's capitol, but I can't vote, then you're telling me that I'm good for everything else but voting. You're telling me I'm good for everything but being a part of society. I, like so many others who reiterate, don't want to simply exist. We want to live, to contribute, and to feel a sense of purpose. We want to belong. When we have a sense of purpose and belonging, we are less likely to recidivate or repeat offenders. Today, not only am I no longer on probation, but because of current laws in Minnesota, I was able to vote this year. For those who have never been denied the vote, you can only imagine how empowering it was. But the current laws is confusing for many, and even those with legal rights to do so hesitate to take the chance. When elections workers and probation officers struggle to understand the law, it would definitely be a barrier for people to try to rebuild their lives. We need laws that everyone can understand and follow. This is not only the moral thing to do, but it's a practical and responsible thing to do. I respectfully ask you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Anyone else from the public wishing to testify on this bill? Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and then go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Shane Price. People call me Brother Shane Price. I represent the Power of People, Personal Development and Leadership Institute. That's a long word. We do three things. We do prevention for girls and boys. We do intervention for men. I work in the intervention area. I have been teaching and training in Minnesota State Correctional Facilities for over 18 years. I have one of the strongest records of success that there is. Some of my successful students are in this room right now. I think that the work that we do has helped promote safety in the state of Minnesota. Something about this bill that I support has been working me in a way I couldn't understand. I attended a community meeting at the Baffney Community Center. Some of the representatives were at that meeting and talked about supporting the bill. But later, had a change of heart. So I'm used to speaking to, in my work, police, corrections officers, lawyers. I'm used to straight talk. We don't have to totally agree on everything, but we do have to talk straight, and I like that. But this particular committee member elected to change his vote, which is his right, when he got to voting time. And this is what he said. He said, I can't forget about the victims. And all the bells in me went off, because that is what has been working me about this particular bill. Because those victims who tried to vote many years ago but couldn't were hung and maimed and brutalized. This is an opportunity to rectify, to restore means to go back and fix it, to restore not just the rights of those individuals who are here today, not just the rights of those who have the privilege of voting in the future, but to go back and rectify, to restore some of the wrong that has been done in the past. This is why this bill is so powerful to me. And this is why I think Minnesota has the opportunity to be on the right side of history. I would respectfully ask you to support this bill, and thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you for your testimony.
Yes, sir.
Anyone else from the public wishing to testify on this bill?
I do.
All right, well, come on down. Yeah. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and then go ahead with your testimony.
All right. My name is Sandy Woodrow Yancey, and I'm here with the Barbershop and Black Congregation Cooperative. I have made some bad decisions in my life in the past that have led me to being incarcerated. I was released October 4th of 2022 due to an early release program for nonviolent offenders. By sharing grace, I was released early. I'm a father of three who, have, as of last week, has been awarded full custody of my twin sons by the courts. I've committed myself to positive change. I also say this to say it's been my unrelentless goal to change the narrative. I'm here today just as myself, but also in representation to have a voice for others like me. Knowledge is power and empowerment. The lack of information surrounding voting laws and rights, a lot of formerly incarcerated people don't understand that their right to vote has been restored after you complete your supervision. I personally don't believe this is a coincidence. Furthermore, the bill that is being introduced extends the voice of formerly incarcerated people. Having a voice and choosing to exercise your right to vote is inclusion. The importance of your vote is not just simply about an election, but also letting the voter know that his or her decisions matter as well. This endorses inclusion in the community. Everyone here today understands that. Our local election impacts us more directly than a popular presidential race. After being released back into the community, our voice should matter right away, not after supervision. This restriction for some can be for many years. This is one of the contributing factors of recidivism. We are not here just fighting for voting rights for formerly incarcerated people, but we are here fighting for acknowledgement of the psychological warfare that goes on after you're released. Change occurs when you're afraid of remaining the same. If you believe in our correctional system, this is a direct contradiction. Nobody is more directly impacted than a formerly incarcerated individual. Other states have already made such bills like this and have passed them. Restrictions like this, I believe, also targets inclusion of people of color. And I think this bill needs a change, and it should be passed right away. And I am what democracy looks like, because I have changed and committed myself to change, and I'm here today in representation of that. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Anyone else from the public wishing to testify? Please introduce yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
Hello, I'm a leader with the Barbershop and Black Congregations Cooperative. My name is Emmanuel Bio.
I use they, them pronouns, and I am a victim of rape, sexual assault, and a hate crime that actually happened a month ago. I'm a queer black individual who graduated from college last May, and is, you know, working now as a community organizer. And I, as a victim of multiple forms of sexual assault and rape and hate crimes, am in support of this bill. Not because I think, you know, I would give my abusers any of those rights, but more because I'm considerate. I grew up having a very critical mind, grew up having a very questioning mind, my parents would say. But the one thing I always knew was I always cared about people and I always cared about others. And so I would like everybody to understand that even though I went through these things, my abusers aren't the people I'm scared of. The people that usually sit in your seats are usually the ones that I'm afraid of. Not because, you know, you guys are horrible people. All of you look gorgeous, by the way. But it's because you are the deciding factor of a multitude of effects. Earlier today, there was conversations about supporting victims. I would be one of those victims. And I think I'd rather see a world where people were genuinely changed than just see a world where we brushed people under a rug and put them in a prison cell. I recently had a conversation with one of my abusers who had given me HIV. And we were talking, and I realized that he was the more broken one than I was. And I see that within a lot of the people I organize around, the people I organized for. I door knocked last year, and the heartbreak that I saw of people who wanted to get that red sticker, who wanted to go to the polls, who wanted to actually feel heard, and the despair of that. That's why I support this bill, and that's why I think you should. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for your testimony. I think voices like yours are not always heard in these spaces, and so I thank you for being here today and sharing your testimony with us. Anyone else from the public wishing to testify? All right.
Good evening.
Please introduce yourself and then go ahead with your
testimony.
My name
is Raymond Muse. Brian Johnson, I think you're a waste of taxpayers' dollars.
Sir.
Secondly, here's my story.
You do have a right to testify, but you must have missed the beginning of committee. We're very respectful here, even yes. If we disagree. Okay?
Even if the committee is. Okay, thank you. So here's my story. I work on campaigns. I work on a lot of campaigns. And most of the people that I encounter are over in North Minneapolis. And they tell me, hey, man, I don't want to vote. Or a female say, I can't vote. I'm not going to sign up to vote. I do voter registration. You know, I do voter registration. And I'm like, how come? You know, felons can vote. They said, that ain't true. Felons can't vote. You know, and I'm like, well, if you go there, if you're off of all papers, you can vote. And so it's like a farce to them. It's like they don't believe, you know. Recently, I was in a relationship, and, here I am, a registered voter, and I got everything in line, and I register people to vote. And I can't even register my relationship partner, who was a previous felon. No papers, no none, but the felon just keep on following her. So I'm like, you can register to vote, but for some reason or another, she was unable to. I did everything within my power to get her registered, but it didn't work. So I think this right here needs to be addressed and passed. I think we would have a lot more voters, American voters, black or white, voting, and it would help to steer this country in the right direction as long as this state is. You know? Thank you. I appreciate your time.
All right. We're going to move on to member discussion. Let's see. Representative Grossler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah. And Representative Frazier, you and I have talked about this a few times now.
We have.
And, you know, I appreciate where you're coming from, and I know you appreciate where I'm coming from. Both of us, in our conversations, believe in accountability. You know, so I don't doubt that at all. I guess I Madam Chair, I've got a few questions. May I go ahead and
yeah,
ask
just
those?
Keeping in mind that several of your colleagues want to have a
certainly,
a
Madam
too.
Chair.
So go ahead, Representative Grossler.
Thank you. I guess I'll read through them. You'll probably answer them all just in a series, but just tell me how many felony crimes lose their right to vote forever?
Thank you for the question, Representative Grosso. You did ask me this question before. I don't have that answer off the top of my head, but I can get it for you.
Right.
Okay.
Representative Grosso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Today in Minnesota, their voting rights are restored, if I'm not wrong, upon completion of their sentence.
That's correct.
Okay. And if they're serving their time, you know, are their voting rights even restored upon completion of that sentence, even if they have to register as a predatory offender?
Representative Frazier.
I, if there's researchers here that know that answer, I don't know that answer off the top of my head.
I'm sure we can find out. Do you know? Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members, I know that this question has come up, and a colleague of mine has reached out to the Secretary of State's office for some input. I have not been told if there's been a response, so I do not have an answer to that question today.
All right. No, sir, there will be no discussion from the audience. When we get that information, we'll make sure that we can both post it and share it with committee members. Any additional questions, Representative Grossler?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And with that, I mean, right now in our state, felony prosecutions, those who have felony prosecutions on their record will have their rights restored upon completion of their sentence.
Representative Frazier.
Upon completion of the entire sentence, yes.
Yes, okay.
Representative Grossel.
So thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess I'm looking at this going, we're already doing this. And I appreciate where you're coming from as far as you want to move that up. But we also have, and we've seen examples of places where we need to have people finish out those sentences so that they can show that they have become a good member of society. They're known by their fruit, correct?
Representative Frazier.
Representative Grosso, thank you for your statements. What you just said that we already do this. We don't already do this. We require individuals. In the state of Minnesota, we have prolonged periods of supervision outside of the incarceral state. So we have individuals that can be on supervision for 20 years in the community, working a job, paying taxes, taking care of their families, in close proximity to issues that they have a real strong voice in, but they cannot vote. They cannot choose their representative. They don't get to participate in that process. They are still considered or treated like outsiders within their community. So I would disagree that we're already doing this, and we are prolonging the opportunity of folks to really, truly reintegrate back into their community.
I guess that was
final follow-up, Representative Grossler. I've got Finke, Mulder, Scott, Niska, Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right.
And I guess, you know, I look at this and I'm going, we're doing this. People are having their votes restored. There are certain ones who do not. And more than likely, there's good reason for that. And I'm sure some of these folks, you would agree that they need to be held accountable and finish that time of their sentence to ensure that, you know, that they are not going to reoffend. And I can see where you're coming from as well. But again, the good gentleman came down and he brought up victims. And I concur with this gentleman behind me that was a victim of these crimes. You know, but there are some victims who will never, and Rep. Novotny brought this up, made this comment in public safety not too long ago. There are victims who will never get the opportunity to vote again. So I guess I'm looking at it thinking that we are one of the least incarceration states in the country, and it's growing to be more less incarceration, and going more to probation, and there's even probation caps now. So to have people finish that time, you know, I think is a fair and just way to do things. But I will not be supporting this today, but there's more conversation to be had. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn. Thank you, Representative Frazier, for bringing this bill. I believe this is one of the most important bills that we will vote on this year. I similar to the question I had about the cannabis bill, I just wanted to quickly check, and I didn't see when we are doing something to right a wrong that has been done to an individual in our society, it's up to us to make sure it happens with urgency. So I just want to make sure that I was reading through the language around, you know, those who are running the carceral state are in charge of letting folks know upon their release, but I just want to make sure there is a timely manner in which everyone who is already out will be informed of their restoration of rights and that there is a process in place for that, as well as for educating individuals at the polling places to ensure that rights that have been restored will be honored at those locations.
Representative Frazier, any comment to that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Finke. Yes, that is part of the work that the Secretary of State will be responsible. Secretary of State, I believe someone is here from the office, but that will be part of the work that the Secretary of State will be taking up to ensure that folks are notified and aware that their rights have been restored.
Great. Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, victims have been brought up today. They've been brought up in the Public Safety Committee. And victims are not a monolith, but I will say that victim survivors support this bill. If you take a look at the letter in your packet from the victim advocacy organization, Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition, the Coalition Against Sexual Assault, Violence Free Minnesota, and the Minnesota Alliance on Crime, which is the General Crime Victim Coalition, these organizations represent victim advocates who work with victims in every county in our state. And they strongly support this bill. Victims, survivors of violence, they say, want restorative, community-strengthening initiatives to help build safer, more engaged communities. And in my career, working with victims and caring deeply about victim rights, this is something that victims support. And so I just am frustrated when we hear people say that we're not doing this on behalf of that victims don't want this, because victims do want this. And so thank you so much for bringing this bill.
Thank you. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Frazier. I think there's going to be disagreement on the line where this bill draws the line, but I did want to talk a little bit about where I think there is common ground in a few different places, and maybe suggest some ways that we can get beyond just whether we agree or disagree on the lines that this bill is drawing. I think we agree across the aisle that accountability for crimes can include loss of freedom and loss of rights, including for at least some period of time a loss of the right to vote. And I also think that there is agreement on both sides of the aisle that rehabilitation is important. It's a beautiful thing when it happens, and that once the price that we as a society agree should be paid for a crime has been paid, that rights should be restored. I think I think we all in this room agree on that. I think where we disagree and where this bill gets tricky and this issue gets tricky is a disagreement on what the price is or when the price has been paid, and specifically whether probation or supervised release should be regarded as part of that price. And I did want to suggest and kind of build on, I think, the comment you made, which is that Minnesota, and Representative Grossel also got this, and some of the testifiers did, which is that Minnesota has, especially compared to other states, been much more on the side of less incarceration for some crimes that maybe, in my opinion, sometimes there should be more incarceration. But also, I think we all would agree that Minnesota, and I think even the advocates of this policy in the past in Minnesota agree that Minnesota goes way too far down the line of having very extended periods of supervision and probation. And so I think the place where there's disagreement across the aisle is in some of those circumstances, whether a very long period of supervised release, whether that price has been paid for that crime the instant that person walks out of incarceration, or if they are not incarcerated but subject to a long period of supervised release. And so maybe we can work on that. Maybe that can be part of the focus, is trying to not put people into a situation where they're trapped in a long period of supervised release, that as a society we maybe should agree that at some point in that we regard that penalty as having been paid. But I, the way, the place where this bill draws the line, I don't, you know, agree that in all those circumstances that price has been paid. So that's why I don't support the bill as it is now. But I hope we can figure out how to, across the aisle, understand where each other is coming from and where we can work together and, you know, the values that we do share. So thank you.
All right. Representative Johnson, keeping in mind that Representative Scott would also like to speak.
Chair Beckerpin, Representative Frazier, I understand what you're trying to do here. We've been dealing with this bill for numerous years. I do have a hypothetical question for you. Now, every person on probation that I've talked to and dealt with in my career in law enforcement, they knew the exact date they got off paper. They know it better than their birthday or their anniversary. They know the date they're off paper. So there's never any confusion on that part of it. But what I'm wondering, how this bill would work if a person was on supervised release, probation, and he happens to have a warrant for his arrest. Now, he's on probation for a serious felony, whether it's a homicide, not criminal sexual assault, a very serious felony. And he violates that, not a technical violation, a true violation. And he has a warrant for his arrest to be reincarcerated. Because he hasn't been caught, does he still have that right to vote by this bill?
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Johnson, thank you for that question. The way the bill is drafted, as long as the individual is not in the incarceral state, the individual would have the ability to vote, and then the moment they go back into the incarceration state, they will lose that right to vote.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Beckerpin, Representative Frazier, that's the problem. There's a warrant for his arrest. He's supposed to be incarcerated. He's avoiding arrest. He should not have that right to vote.
May I respond to that?
Representative
Johnson, I got to tell you, I know some folks that have gone through the system, and I want to address the first thing you said. Even an individual that knows the date that they're off paper, where the issue happens is that some folks believe that even if they're off paper, as long as they've been adjudicated as a felon, they never have the right to vote. So that's one of the issues there. But I can tell you, there's a highly unlikelihood that someone that has a warrant, know they have a warrant, will show up to vote anywhere and risk the opportunity of being caught to go back to prison.
Representative Johnson, real quick, no more hypotheticals today.
No more hypotheticals. But I actually did arrest a person while I was voting on a warrant.
Well, then you caught him. So I guess that there's your answer right there in that one hypothetical. Representative Scott, and then we're going to move to the vote.
Madam Chair, these are probably just more comments than a question, but my concern here is
one of the testifiers said, you've served your time, you've been rehabilitated, and now you get on a probation. Well, there's no guarantee that someone is truly rehabilitated. And I am a person that highly believes in second chances. But my concern with this is that there's no criteria after they're released from incarceration that determines whether or not they really are safe to be out in society. And I don't know what that looks like, Representative Frazier. I don't know if it's like a waiting period after they've been incarcerated, to kind of have a time of proving themselves in society that they're not going to reoffend. I don't know if that's 6 months, a year, but that's my concern. And I just also wanted to add that if my daughter had been brutally raped, I'm not sure I'd feel the same way that Mikasa does about somebody having their voting rights restored right after they're released from incarceration. I think I would probably feel that a little more deeply that this person needs to live out the full sentence for the crime that they committed. Thank you, members.
All right, closing words, Vice Chair Frazier.
Yeah, just to that point that Rep. Scott made, Mikasa does represent and advocate for individuals, just as you mentioned, and those individuals have spoken to the fact that they would prefer to see individuals totally restored once they're back in the community. Our systems, we have a process to determine whether or not someone we believe them to be safely back in the community. So there is a process for that, and it happens before they are released back into the community. So there's that kind of fail-safe there, and once we release them back to the community on supervised release, we're saying we believe you're safe to be back in the community. But the way our system is designed now, we're saying, but we don't believe you should actually be included in the community. We don't believe your voice should actually count in the community. And that is the problem. That is the disparity, that is the inequity that we're seeing here, and we're trying to correct with House File 28. Madam Speaker, I'll just say, and committee members, thank you for the conversation. I'll just say, throughout this process, throughout the several committees, we've had tons of testifiers, and we can tell the importance of this bill by the number of folks that continue to show up and to tell this story over and over again. These folks are truly being felt like they're not included in their communities, and they want to be more engaged in the community. They've talked about what that feels like, how important it would be to be able to have that voice in our electoral process. It is our job, it is our obligation to create situations that will restore faith back in the system and also keep our communities safe. And we've heard folks testify to how that will be done by giving them this right back to vote. I urge you all to vote yes on this bill. And Madam Chair, with that, I will request a roll call on this vote.
All right, a roll call having been requested, Vice Chair Frazier renews his motion that House File 28 as amended be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker-Finn.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Aye.
Minority Leader Scott.
No.
Representative Carroll.
Aye.
Representative Curran.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Finke.
Aye.
Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Niska.
No.
Representative Weens.
No.
With 8 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails and the bill is on its way to Ways and Means. Sorry, members, I tried really hard to end us on time, but we're talking about civil rights and there were members of the public who wanted to testify. So thank you for your patience today. With that, we are adjourned.